Continuing in mitzvah, Tafhei 405, the mitzvah of shofar on Rosh Hashanah, the mitzvah of what the shofar? Hearing the shofar or blowing the shofar. The Minchas Chinuch discusses that there's you can analyze it different ways, whether the mitzvah is to blow or to hear. So the pashtu, what?
The bracha, the shmoa kosher.
So the bracha paskins that the mitzvah is to hear it, but there are some rishonim who say that the bracha is al tkiya shofar. But the more commonly accepted understanding is that the mitzvah is to hear it, because the famous, as we'll discuss later, the famous Mishnah says that if you blow the shofar into a pit and you hear an echo instead of the actual direct sound of the shofar, so then you're not yotze. So the mitzvah to blow the shofar is no difference. So you can't. The mitzvah seems to be that you have to hear the shofar, but again, it has to be done by a bar chiyuva. That it has to be someone who's obligated in the mitzvah shofar, that even though, again, if the mitzvah is just to hear the sound, so you can imagine if you had a robot blowing the shofar, so you heard the sound of the shofar. No, but it doesn't work like that. That it still has to be blown by someone who's obligated in the mitzvah as well. Yeah.
Okay, so obligated, but let's say somebody goes ahead and he's, you know, baltikeia, you know, saying shul, and then he goes off to a hospital, let's say, or something like that, and blows again.
Yeah.
He's no longer obligated.
Yes. So that's the famous principle of Arvus, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh B'Zeh, that the entire Jewish people are obligated for each other. So that's why one is allowed to perform a mitzvah again on behalf of someone else, even though you were already Yotze, and even make the bracha. That ideally, again, the people who are not Yotze already should make the bracha. But if they're not so knowledgeable and they don't know how to make the bracha, so then the Baltikeia would be allowed to blow the shofar with a bracha again for these people. With a bracha, assuming again that the person for whom he is blowing is obligated to the shofar. If you're blowing it again, women are not obligated to the shofar. Therefore, if a man is blowing again for a woman, so then he would not be allowed to make the bracha. This principle extends to basically everything, that even if it's the whole mitzvah is a bracha, like, for example, making Kiddush. So even if you made Kiddush already, then somebody, you encounter somebody who hasn't yet heard Kiddush. So, for example, you know, sometimes you are having guests Friday night, so some of your guests arrive on time and you make Kiddush on behalf of everyone. And then you have a guest who wanders in an hour late. Yes, whoops, yes. We got lost, we couldn't find it. So then technically you'd be allowed to make Kiddush again, but if the people know how to make Kiddush themselves, they make Kiddush themselves. But technically, even with a Bor Pri HaGafen in that case, because it's an intrinsic part of Kiddush, ordinarily you're not allowed to make an optional bracha, an eating type of bracha, on behalf of someone else if you were Yotze already. But in this situation, you can, because it's intrinsically bound up to Kiddush. V'chein minyan ha-mitzvah, ma'ashom ha-zichon ha-l'racha, she-kol ha-kolos k'sherim ba-shofar. That the type of sound, again, we have certain prescribed lengths and qualities of the sound, but in terms of the type of sound musically, it doesn't matter. So, for example, if the shofar is very deep as a nice or if it's just, or somebody, sometimes about Tekea, can't get the sound out right and just goes so that's also good. So it's if any type of sound is kosher, there's no in terms of depth or quality of the sound that is prescribed, although of course you obviously want to do it in a nicer, more meaningful, more moving way. Yeah.
Who determined that you have to hear 100 colors?
Who determined?
Yeah.
The Aruch mentions it. It was a custom that arose. Sometimes Jews start doing things, you know, of their own accord.
Mm-hmm. 100 just arose.
Well, then we link it into the fact that there's a tradition that when Sisera, when the mother of Sisera was an evil general who was killed by Yael, and we have it in the Haftorah for Parshas B'Shalach. So since his mother cried 100 times... Yeah, that's the
to record it.
That's the tradition, that she cried 100 times when she was waiting for Sisera to come home from battle, and Sisera never came home because he got killed by Yael. So that's why you blow the shofar 100 times. A lot of drushy literature about why we connect the shofar to the mother of Sisera, because, you know, okay, we're very sad, you know, she was, but not, she probably wasn't such a great person to raise a son like that. But, that's a presumption.
What? Minimum necessary, though, is what, like...
Nine. We'll get there. Yeah, 100 kolos is not halachically necessary. If you're in a people are in a hospital and somebody comes to visit and blow shofar, then you just blow the minimum of... Nowadays, a 30, but technically it's 9, which we'll discuss... in a few minutes.
There's 100 brachas a day. I mean, there seems to be this 100 idea.
The 100 brachas a day is mentioned in the Gemara. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's already in the Tanoim.
Is that a whole number or something? What is 100?
It's a good question. So there's a tradition by Mea Brachas that in the times of David HaMelech, there was a plague, and 100 people died each day. So in order to rectify the sins that led 100 people to die each day, so David HaMelech instituted that everyone should make 100 brachas each day, in order to do that. So it's also obviously pegged. It's not the real meaning of the pasuk, but it's pegged on the pasuk that it says, "Ma Hashem Elokecha Shoel Meimach." What does the Lord your God ask of you? So "Ma Hashem Elokecha" sounds like Mea. So God asks of you 100 things. So it's pegged on that as well. So it's a requirement that you have to make 100 brachos every day. So on a normal, regular day, this is, does not pose any problems, because even in the regular course of affairs, if you're daven 3 times a day and you eat some meals and snacks, and it shouldn't be a problem. The problem is when you have Shabbos, where you have fewer brachos built into the schedule because there's no Shmon Esrei. The Shmon Esrei, the Amida, only has 7 brachos instead of 18, 19. And you have a few extra brachas like Kiddush, but it doesn't really make up for it. So that's why you're supposed to have extra snacks on Shabbos, not in the context of a meal, in order to get Mea Brachas. Yeah.
Inyan of the mother of Sisera.
Yeah.
It's perhaps also intended to signify that even though it was a mother or someone who was such a Sisera, but the fact that the mother is the universal element here, and the Indian of motherhood, of being something so significant, of being something so genuine, something so honest, something so powerful, that is what is incorporated into our Hashkafa.
Even for wicked people, yes. That we show we have Rachmanas on them, because the maternal instinct is so, yeah, right. You're a good darshan. Well, yeah, you're right. That's part of the thing, and it's also connected to the fact that some say that Sari Imenu cried 100 times when she heard about the Akedah. I don't know, the different traditions to these effect, but the 100 shofar blasts again is not a halachic requirement. It's a minhag, a very strong minhag, but that only applies in shul. If you're having the shofar blown for you privately, so you don't have to observe the minhag of 100 shofar blasts. V'amru gam ken she'im gardu ha-shofar ad she'amido al-gildo kosher. That if you scrape the shofar so thin that it's just like paper, like the shofar becomes paper thin, then that is kosher. That is a kosher shofar. There's no minimum requirement for the thickness of the shofar. The only minimum requirement is for the length of the shofar. The length of the shofar, again, has to be so that you hold it in your hand and it protrudes from either side. That's the minimum. That's the minimum.
It brings out the appropriate sound, which is the vibrating sound that's needed.
So right.
The thickness of the instrument is not something which affects the true quality.
Correct, because any of the sound is kosher. So, yes. So that
would be more like a kazoo, though. I mean, it's going to be vibrating.
So. Maybe, okay. Okay, but there's
somebody who can do it on a straw.
Well, there
makes it sound like it.
There are other things that are not kosher by a shofar, which is, for example, debake shivrei shofros. That if you have take scraps, shards of shofros, and you press them together and you form a shofar, then that's no good. It still has to be the natural form of the shofar. There was a famous story that there was a scandal that there was someone who was producing shofros that were amazing. They were all perfect. They all looked great. They all blew perfectly. So somebody went to his factory to investigate what's he doing with how does he get all his shofros to be so perfect. So what he was doing is he was taking shofros. It was shofar material. He was taking shofros or pieces of shofros and melting them down and pouring them into molds. Mm-hmm. So that's puzzle. That's the
can
big shift.
Melt them down? Down?
Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah, you melt it. Yeah.
Dissolve?
Wouldn't they look melt different? Them. I mean, wouldn't they look funny? They would be.
Maybe.
Probably.
I don't know. I never saw. I don't think I ever saw one of these.
They wouldn't have like streaks or anything. They would be all like.
I don't know. I don't know. Well, there's not. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe the streaks don't melt completely. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Well,
so this was a problem. And this is why nowadays you have. When I was growing up, you never had this, a hechsher on the shofar. Now you get you go to the store when you buy a shofar. It usually has a sticker on it with a hechsher on it. So that was partially caused. The market for a hechsher on shofaros was partially caused. By this scandal that arose where somebody actually was producing and selling shofars which were really not kosher.
When did that happen?
I don't know exactly. Rav Schechter tells the story as if it were many years ago.
30 years ago.
I got the impression it was more like 30 years ago.
Conceptually, if you grind it down and mix it with something as a binding factor, then you can make other things from it, but you would need external non-shofar material in order for it to be possible to reconstitute it into
really?
All together.
I got the impression that what this guy was doing is his shofars were 100% made of shofar. Just
no
melted
glue?
Shofar.
Oh,
no,
it's got to
so.
Sort of, have some sort of glue because, I mean, organic material, which is what shofar is, cannot really be melted as such.
Well,
no, I don't know, actually, because it's keratin. You know, the horn is made of keratin, which is basically like fingernail material, which is protein.
Yeah.
It's a protein.
So cut off your nails and try to melt them and see what happens.
It's possible. It's not like
I bought mine from Yaakov Ellman, of blessed memory, at Rabinowitz and had to be kosher.
Okay.
No way. What is it?
Okay, okay. Masha Amr Zichron Levracha, She Yantev Shal.
The woman is not required. She also can't blow for someone.
She can't blow for a man.
She can't blow like Kiddush.
No, not like Kiddush.
Not like Kiddush.
Kiddush, technically, a woman can make for a man.
For a man?
Sure.
Really?
She has probably a higher level of chiyuv
because
she didn't go to shul and she didn't say...
Right, that's the cute vort that people say, that we have this new modernisha thing that in some households... The husband makes Kiddush and the wife makes Hamotzi. But if Shabbos morning, that's no question at all. That's Bari Priya Gofen. Of course, a woman can make a Bari Priya Gofen on behalf of a man. So that's why some people say, so if you have a household where the husband makes Kiddush and the wife makes Hamotzi, really it should be the opposite. The wife should make Kiddush and the husband should make Hamotzi. Why? Because the husband davened already. Myriv. So he said Mekadesh Shabbos, he davened Shmoneh Esrei, which midoraisa fulfills the obligation of Kiddush, and now the obligation to make Kiddush on wine is only the Rabbanan, whereas the wife maybe didn't daven, so therefore she's now obligated in Kiddush midoraisa. So now it's a shaila if the husband who's obligated now only midorabbanan can be motzi the wife who's only. Who is midoraisa, that she has the higher, he has the higher level of obligation. So it's a shayla again whether you apply. It's a whole huge hack about how if the men and women how they're included in the concept of arvus that Kol Yisrael Arvim Zebezed. You can make do a mitzvah on behalf of another, even if you were yotzi already. It's a whole big hack. But in the way out of it is that a woman should daven Ma'ariv on Friday nights. Mm-hmm. So really, really, really on in any way because she's chayiv in Kiddush. So the Ma'ariv is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Kiddush. So she should get an extra fulfillment, even if it isn't absolutely 100%. It can't hurt that she should get an extra fulfillment of the mitzvah of Kiddush. That's why many poskim recommend that if a woman doesn't daven Ma'ariv in general. There are some poskim say that women should daven Ma'ariv daily, but that's not the commonly accepted practice. But many poskim strongly recommend that a woman should daven Ma'ariv on Shabbos and Yontif nights, and on Motzi Shabbos and Yontif nights because of the requirement of Havdalah.
What's so beautiful about all of this is that we subject everything to beautiful pilpul.
Yeah.
That's
interesting. Okay. Okay. So a woman cannot blow shofar on behalf of a man. That's for sure. Since she's not obligated at all. Not midoraisa, not midorabanan. But if she wants to volunteer to fulfill the mitzvah, so she can blow on behalf of another woman. You don't blow the shofar on Shabbos. Why? Where does it say?
Carry it to shul.
Oh, So there are two different shitas. The Yerushalmi, the Gemara, the Talmud Bavli entertains this notion, but in the end rejects it. But some interpret the Talmud Yerushalmi, that the Talmud Yerushalmi actually does accept this, that Chumash says at one place, Yom Teruah Yelachem, describing Rosh Hashanah, should be a day of shofar blowing. And another place that Chumash says, Zichron Teruah Mikra Kodesh, a remembrance of Teruah. So you could interpret that remembrance of Teruah doesn't mean that you remember doing it once upon a time, but rather the blowing of the shofar is a remembrance of you before God, that you're blowing the shofar. But the way the Bavli suggests interpreting it, and the Yerushalmi maybe accepts it, is that it means that sometimes it's a Yom Teruah, and sometimes it's just the remembrance of Teruah, that you mention the shofar blowing and davening, and you remember that you used to do it in previous years, but you don't actually do it that year. And the difference being that it's done on when it's on a weekday, you blow the shofar, and when it's on Shabbos, you don't blow the shofar. Mm-hmm. So that's one possibility that the Gemara entertains, that it's actually the straight up halacha that you don't blow the shofar when it falls on Shabbos. However, the accepted conclusion, at least of the Talmud Bavli, is that no, the fundamental mitzvah of shofar requires that it should be blown even on Shabbos, but Gzeira Shema Yitlenu Yisrael Acher or Echad V'yolichenu Arba Amos B'Rishus Harabim V'yavo Lidei Isser Skila. That since not everybody is obligated to blow the shofar, and not everybody knows how to blow the shofar, so you might carry the shofar outside in Rishus Harabim, and you could be subject to the prohibition, the penalty of Skila. Yeah.
Not everybody knows how to learn Gemara. You know, you stop at Gemara outside, too.
Yeah, but this is a specific obligation on this exact day.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Learning is a general obligation, but here you have a specific mitzvah that requires usage of an object. So it has to be done on this particular day. So you might carry it to someone to teach you how to blow the shofar. So again, yovel de iser skila. So obviously you're not talking about real iser skila over here, because you're doing it forgetfully. Nobody's doing it on purpose on Rosh Hashanah, carrying the shofar on Shabbos, but meaning that it's in a category of prohibition that's subject to the penalty of skila should you do it on purpose. So therefore, the chachamim take it very seriously. So in order to protect the sanctity of Shabbos, they said, do not fulfill a biblical mitzvah, in order to make sure that no Jews are chayav on violating Shabbos on Rosh Hashanah. And obviously a similar thing was ordained regarding reading the Megillah on Shabbos, and regarding taking the lulav on Shabbos. So we don't do any of these things, even if the first day of Sukkot falls on Shabbos, because of the concern that you'll carry the lulav outside. Yeah.
It was done in the Beis Hamikdash.
Oh, yes.
So, I mean, wouldn't the same thing, I mean, you know, why should there be a special case with Beis Hamikdash? You know, somebody, you know.
Shaking the lulav was also done in the Beis Hamikdash.
Yeah, right,
the first
right.
Day,
okay.
So, yeah.
Why is it somehow rather that there was figured that nobody was going to, you know, you're not worrying about somebody carrying, you know, in those cases. Certainly with the lulav, since everybody has its own lulav, and, you know, I mean, sure, you slap it over, you know, from the robbing to the, you know.
Right. The Mishnah describes regarding the lulav that obviously everyone was supposed to take the lulav in the Beis Hamikdash, walk around the Mizbeach. But it says that everyone used to leave the lulav on Erev Shabbos in the Beis Hamikdash, so they wouldn't have to carry it to the Beis Hamikdash. But nevertheless, when you have such in the presence of the Beis Hamikdash, something so holy, I guess there's not so much a concern that you're going to forget and you're going to violate a mitzvah. But nowadays we don't have the building, the holiness, the closeness to God. So there's more of a concern that we might forget ourselves and carry the object in Rishus Rabbim. So you see, again, Chazal had their reasons for doing things. That this was a major concern, and they felt that it was more important to make sure that Shabbos would not be violated than to make sure that the biblical obligation was performed at the proper time.
Well, the difference over here is that for Rosh Hashanah is 2 days, so they're both derisive, right?
No. Rosh Hashanah in the times of the in the times of the Sanhedrin and the Beis Hamikdash, so Rosh Hashanah was sometimes 2 days, but it's not a derisive thing. You have to make it 2 days. Rosh Hashanah. The question was that you had a lot of confusion regarding the korbanos, because Rosh Hashanah was a day where it's the same as Rosh Chodesh, so the witnesses had to come to testify that they saw the new moon. So if the witnesses came in the morning and they said, yeah, today is the correct day of Rosh Hashanah, so they used to just keep that one day as the day of Rosh Hashanah. But if they came later in the afternoon, again, make it un Rosh Hashanah-ified. So they used to keep 2 days Rosh Hashanah because the next day was the real day of Rosh Hashanah. But they didn't say, and they didn't want to say, hey, you know, we can stop observing Rosh Hashanah now after you've already done most of the day, observed it as Yontif, and you offered the Karbonos and everything. So that's why it's somewhat conceptually funny that in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, when they used to do 2 days Rosh Hashanah, was the second day of Rosh Hashanah, that was the real day of Rosh Hashanah. Whereas nowadays, we just do Rosh Hashanah, 2 days Rosh Hashanah, because of the tradition that the Sveika de Yoma, that it might not be the correct day. Whether it was, again, the real day of Rosh Hashanah, the main day of Rosh Hashanah is really the first day, because we know what the calendar is supposed to be because of that we have now a fixed calendar.
So in other words, just so far, for us, on the second day, isn't Derisa?
No, for sure. Tekiah Shofar, for us, on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, is only the Rabbanah, yes.
But through the Yom HaRifta, you know, but so how's it that, you know,
Yom HaRifta,
we assume basically it's all one unit. I mean, how does it, you know?
Yom HaRifta really applies to things that are themselves only Derabanan. So, for example, we call and every other 2 days of Yontif. So we have something that we were discussing a little bit last night, which is called Muktzah, which is not the colloquial Muktzah, which is things you're not allowed to handle on Shabbos and Yontif, but rather that in order for something to be consumed on a Yontif, it has to be prepared in advance, has to be known about in advance. So, for example, if an egg, this is the famous Mishnah, on the first Mishnah of Maseches Beitzah, states that if an egg is laid on the first day, on the Mishnah doesn't say this exactly, but the Gemara extrapolates. Talking about whether if an egg is laid on Yontif, you're allowed to eat it that day. So if an egg is laid on Yontif, you're not allowed to eat it that day. But if it's 2 days of Yontif, so if an egg was laid on the first day of Yontif, you're allowed to eat it on the second day of Yontif. Because if the yesterday was Yontif, then today is a weekday. And if the yesterday was today is Yontif, yesterday was a weekday, so you're allowed to eat the egg because of that reason. So when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, we say because the concept to a certain extent behind the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah is different from the concept behind the 2 days of other Yom Tovim, because it was done even in the times of the Beis HaMikdash sometimes, then even though today it is a similar concept, but it's based on something that was a different concept, then the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah are like one long day. So if an egg is laid on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, so it's not allowed to be eaten on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. As we say, Rosh Hashanah is like one long day. It doesn't literally mean that it's the 2 days are like are one day on the Derisa level. There's also discussion. So,
one clarification.
Yeah,
it's called muksa. The different kind of muksa. For example, obviously you can go and take the egg and put it in the refrigerator or something. It's not muksa.
It is muksa also.
Under the hen or something.
Yeah, you don't have to. If you don't have to refrigerate eggs, this is American. This is an American zach.
Yeah.
In other countries, they don't refrigerate eggs, but in America, they do refrigerate eggs because they're processed a little bit differently before they get to you. Okay, but that's Lemaisa, I'm not saying you shouldn't refrigerate eggs. In America, you should refrigerate eggs, but in other countries where eggs are not as heavily processed before they reach your house, so then you don't have to refrigerate eggs.
They taste better.
That's what we're talking about at Yom HaRichta. Also, we know that you're not allowed to prepare or do malacha on the first day of Yontif for the sake of the second day of Yontif. So, according to some shitas, again, we rely on this as a tziruf, not on all by itself, but according to some shitas, you're allowed to prepare and do malacha on the first day of Rosh Hashanah for the second day of Rosh Hashanah. So how does that make sense? Midaraisa, the first day is the real day, and the second day is chol. But nevertheless, in most cases, even if you do malacha on the first day of Yontif for the second day of Yontif, it's only going to be a prohibition midrabanan. It's not going to be a prohibition midaraisa. So, for example, and say take a regular day of Pesach, a regular Yontif like Pesach. So, if you, let's say, you cook a stew on the first day of Yontif, and you say, "I'm eating this tonight at the second Seder." I mean, it's not the second Seder, so you're not allowed to do that. But is it a prohibition midaraisa? The simple understanding is that it's not a prohibition meat the raisa because you could eat it now. In other words, it's not a desecration of yantif per se. So some people say, so that's only the rabbanon. So then, since the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah are like Yom Arichta, then you're allowed to prepare on 1 day of Rosh Hashanah for the next day of Rosh Hashanah, which again we don't really rely on, but maybe use it as a tznif, an additional grounds for leniency in certain situations. So you don't blow the shofar on Shabbos because you might carry it, even if there's an Eruv. Nevertheless, you don't carry the shofar at all because maybe you'll get to a place where there is no Eruv and you carry it. Again, it's somewhat far-fetched, but again, the Chachamim went to such great lengths to defend the sanctity of Shabbos, especially regards the prohibition of carrying, that they even enacted decrees such as this.
If you're leading an animal by a leash, either a dog or a goat, and it's too heavy,
yeah,
is that permitted on Shabbos?
In Rosh Hashanah? Yeah, it is permitted. There are restrictions that you're not allowed to have the leash dangle very far out of your hand, because the stuff that's out of your hand is considered extra. So if it dangles a tefach out of your hand, or you wrap it around your hand or something like that, then that's no good. But if you're just holding on to the very end of the leash, then the animal is considered to be wearing the leash, you're not considered to be carrying the leash.
So you can walk a dog on Shabbos.
There's a way to do it. Yeah, there is a way to walk a dog on Shabbos. Yes, or to walk a goat on Shabbos, the case may be. I like your pet goat better than the dog.
And what about picking up the
soil?
Yeah, the poop, whatever. I don't know.
Oh, that's a hotzah. No, it's not allowed. How could
you? Right. So you can't.
Yeah, how could you? In New York City, you can't. Then. You know.
Yeah. How could you carry the? You can't carry the bags or the right. itself.
Well,
I mean, if you have.
And if you're in the A-Roo.
It's
graf shel rei. So if something, there's an exception to the rules of muktzah. If something is disgusting and you have to get rid of it, then you're allowed to move it, ordinarily would be muktzah. Yeah. So if there are, even in your house, say, so if you have residue from the table, so you have, chewed on chicken bones or fruit pits. So that's muktzah. So you're not allowed to move that. It's not edible. It's not a kli. It's not a vessel. So that's, you're not allowed to handle that on Shabbos. But if it's soiling the table, you eat that Friday night and you want to set it for the next meal, and it's soiling the table and it's disgusting, then you are allowed to move it because of the principle of graf shel rei. So if you're in an Erev, then you would be allowed to clean up your dog on Shabbos. Okay. But if there's nothing, that there's not an Erev, so there's nothing to discuss. V'davar zeh lo gozru osa chachamim v'makom sheisham bezdin shu godol b'chachma. So this also, the chachamim did not make this gzera if you're in the presence of a very wise rabbinical court. V'davkin shetoken osa sham b'shivas habezdin. That you have to blow it when the bezdin is in session. So what's the what categorizes a very great Bezdin?
You can't have a Bezdin in session on Yom Tov, can you?
No, they're just sitting around together. Okay, they could be answering shilas, not judging monetary disputes. Yeah. Fine. So good. So a great Bezdin. So the Vada Rabbanim of Washington Heights gets together, and we sit down on Rosh Hashanah. We say no. So let's blow the shofar and watch lights on Rosh Hashanah. Does that count? The Rambam Zal Kosav Shetzorich Liyod HaBezdin Somuch Beretz Yisrael. It has to have real smicha that was from Eretz Yisrael, which we don't have anymore. But she had Bezdin Meula Meosan Shekitchu Asachodesh. Is someone that would be qualified to sanctify the new month. So we don't have that. So we don't have that anymore. So others say it has to be a Sanhedrin Ktana. That has to be 23 Dayanim who have a real smicha. That you would be allowed to blow the shofar in their presence on Shabbos. So that's the accepted opinion. However, there's a famous dissenting opinion of the Rif. Vani shamati sharav Reb Yitzchak Alfasi Zal hayatokea shofar b'shivaso b'Shabbos. That the Rif did not have real smicha, and the Rif lived in Morocco, so knew what's going on. So the Rif felt not like this. He said no. It doesn't apply only to people who have real smicha, who were authorized to sanctify the new months. It applies to a bezdin that's considered one of the greatest authorities on Jewish law in this generation. The Rif used to blow the shofar in his Bezdin on Shabbos, but his students even did not follow this practice. This was considered a very singular opinion, and it has not been followed since. There was also, since we also pointed out that the Sefer Chinuch doesn't mention it explicitly, but one of the exceptions is the Beis HaMikdash. As we said, the blue used to blow the shofar in the Mikdash. So, what does the Mikdash mean? What does it mean, the Beis HaMikdash? So we have the famous Machlokia, so the famous unique Shita of the Rambam, that when this comes into play regarding the mitzvah of Lulav as well, that the mitzvah of Lulav outside the Beis HaMikdash is Midaraisa only on the first day of Sukkos. And it's Midaraisa all 7 days of Sukkos in the Beis HaMikdash. So the Rambam writes in the Perush HaMishnayis that maybe in this context, Mikdash means the entire city of Yerushalayim. Or at least the old city, something like that. The area that you could eat Maaser Sheni, for example, or Korbanos in the times of Beis HaMikdash, it's all considered the Beis HaMikdash, the whole city of Yerushalayim. So that's why the Bikur Yankiv, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, writes that maybe, according to the Rambam, if you go to the old city of Yerushalayim nowadays, and you go to the Kotel for davening a Chol HaMoed Sukkos, so maybe you have to bench a little Venesrig Midoraisa, even on the days subsequent days of Sukkos after the first. So there were some controversial figures when they in the 19th century, I think, when the Jews were moving more en masse back to Eretz Yisrael. So they wanted to institute blowing the shofar in the old city of Yerushalayim on Shabbos. They said, this is like the Mikdash. This is like the Mikdash. If you look at the Rambam in the parish, HaMishnayis. So most people did not accept this at all, because simple understanding is that even if the entire city has a status of Mikdash, that's only in the times when the Beis HaMikdash is standing, and the city fulfills its function as being part of the Beis HaMikdash complex. But if the city does not form part of the Beis HaMikdash complex, you can't eat Korbanos there, for example, so for sure this would not apply, and this idea was rejected by just about everyone besides a very small group of people who wanted to institute this on Shabbos, and that's the story. So now we've not heard of blowing the shofar on Shabbos. Instead of giving him the option of choosing, if he wants to do like the Rif, that seems very strange.
All right. I don't know. It
seems
very pretty highly of a son.
Yeah. Seems strange. Okay. וכן מעניין המצווה מה שאומר זיכרון לברכה שחייב אדם לזכוע בראש השנה שלוש תקיעו של שלוש שלוש. So you have to blow three sets of three blasts. What does that mean? כלומר שלוש פעמים תקיעה ותרועה ותקיעה. So the way it works is you blow תקיעה, תרועה, תקיעה three times. תקיעה, תרועה, תקיעה, תקיעה, תרועה, תקיעה, תקיעה, תרועה, תקיעה. That's it. Those nine blasts are the דרייס obligation on Rosh Hashanah, which is learned out from the Yovel, really. Uskat v'ha'avartem shofar teruah, it says. V'ha'avartem means, they interpret that v'ha'avartem shofar teruah means that the teruah should be surrounded by two flat blasts. Shenimsa shen sheish tkios v'shalosh teruah. So you have to blow six tkios and three truas. So there is trua. What's a trua? Kitergumo yabava. It says in the Targum Unklus on this pasuk, yom yabava yehei lachon, that it should be a day of wailing. Vinyan yabava, who kol shavor, a broken blast. Kolomar kol yelola, like a wailing type of blast. Nimsha tzatortziv sausanu lasos b'shofar kol hadoma liyelola. It should be a blast that is like a whale. Omibnesha mekomos haolam chalukim binyan hayalola. So what does that mean? What's a do a whale? Everybody do a whale.
Not on
Oh, see, I have some
different places.
So what? There are different types of cries and whales. Shebemakom echad miyalalin beginichos gasos. Some places whale with heavy sighs. Okay? That's one potential option. Or makom echad bedakos.
translation, like the, you know. Like
mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are different ways of doing the Shof Malkom Acher Osin Akol Gasus Vedakos. They go oi 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 oi. So that's how they that's how they will. They have two different they have three different possible options: either the heavy, the short, or the all both together. Benagu b'chol Malkom Malkom Lios Masriyin Baruch Hashan Al Derech Shu Miyalin Ish Ish B'Mekomo. That. This is very fascinating. The other Rishonim present a similar idea, but they say that presented this way, the Sefer Chinuch did it. Other Rishonim say, yeah, they have different minhagim in different places of how to blow the shofar. The Sefer Chinuch says that each place patterned how they blew the shofar based on the minhag in that place. The minhag, not a religious minhag, but the local custom. Of how the people in that place used to cry and wail. So if you were in a place where people used to sigh, so they used to blow the shofar that way. Oh, this is what crying means. So this is how they blow the shofar. It's strange. That would be a place. You think each person individually would be different. But okay, different. It sounds like it was in each place.
Why? A minhag is based on place.
No, but I'm saying he said it was based first on how people express themselves in that place.
Well, it's really like
the halach.
I think Arabs, you know, there's women, right? Some of my brothers, you know, comes to me, I'm sure those people don't know. So ululation is called, you know, like a morning and something like that. There's a, you know, particular kind of a thing, and you know, after all, people they tend to copy other, you know, it's a learned behavior.
Okay.
It's not something which you know.
I hear. Okay.
I think it's, you know, imprinted somehow or other, and you know, your DNA to decide how you're gonna, you know.
I hear. Okay. I hear. In other words, the Torah doesn't really care how you blow the shofar in terms of the trua, as long as it's a wailing type of sound. Any broken sound is good as a trua on a deraisa level. Yeah.
So, of course, I'm sure you're about to explain how, you know, your minhag in the last 40, you know, truas, right?
We'll get there.
Yakasha thing? Okay, fine, good.
The Afalpisha Mekomo Ein Miyalin Kain, it doesn't matter, again, it's just, it was tied into how people used to wail in that place as to how people decided to blow shofar in that place, but it's not that only people from groaning places were yotze with groaning, only people with wailing places were yotze with wailing, no. Any broken sound is good, but it's just if you came from a wailing place and you're visiting a groaning place, so yotze with a groaning too. Any broken sound is good. You did what the Torah says. You did some sort of crying sound with a shofar. Oh, so we have a problem with this. Okay, which is that you have different. You could have. In Washington Heights, they blow the shofar one way, and in Borough Park, they blow the shofar a different way.
Which Washington Heights?
And you could have, in the olden days, you didn't have two different communities in such a close part, maybe in Venice or something. Okay. But you could have, Borough is doing it one way, and you could have Wansani doing it another way. Fine.
YU and Dombrov and Breeders and
Okay. Fine. So the problem was that Jekam Reb Avo v'lo Yoshar Beinov Lios Yisrael Chalukim b'minah Gatrua Zebecho v'Zebecho. He said, I don't like that you have different practices amongst Klal Yisrael regarding such a fundamental mitzvah as shofar. You have some people doing it this way, do something, do it that way. So I'm Shinas the Torah Kishtei Torahs. Looks like they're two different Torahs. Chas v'Shalom. V'kibetz kol haminhagim v'iskin shiotokim v'chol hamakomos v'shoveh. He says, no. I'm making a takana that everyone is going to do all the different styles of blowing. Yeah.
I think it's actually fairly important here because you know, you go to shul on Rosh Hashanah, you don't want to be distracted by saying, what, that's a trua? You know, I mean, it's a...
Yeah, Rabbi, yeah. So you agree with Rabbi Bao, good. V'latzeisi dechova mikla hayalolos shenasos ba'olam tiken lasos ha'trua b'shloshat zdadin. So that we have three different types of trua. Again, on the Deraisa level, there's only one type of blast, which is called a trua. Now we've turned trua into a technical term for one of these particular types of blasts. So one way that we do it is by what we call shvarim, which is the heavy groans. That we go Those are quick wails. That's one of the possibilities of the chua. And some we do both as well, that we start with a, I just gave away the other type of truah. Okay, I'll get to that in a second. But that's one way of doing it. You have to get to three sets of these nine blasts. In other words, one where you're doing what we call a shvarim as the fulfillment of the truah, one where you're doing a truah, what we call a truah, and one where you're doing what we call a shvarim truah. In order to satisfy all the different types of customs that were prevalent in Klal Yisrael. The problem is two things. First of all, now there are more minhagim. So, for example, regarding the Shvarim, there are some places that blow regular straight Shvarim, and some places that go, some of the broken Shvarim. That was the minhag in Lithuania, although some say that everybody agrees that really the Shvarim are supposed to be straight. But the reason they did it in Lithuania that way is to fulfill the sheet of Rashi that holds that Shvarim are supposed to be shorter than the way we blow them. And if they're broken, so then they are shorter. By definition, they can't be extended the same way. Yeah.
Actually, broken means that the Valkea is, tongues are stuck, stops,
It's just there's an obvious change in tone. So the regular Shvarim, actually, they say that Rav Henkin used to say this, others pointed out as well, that really, since there's no difference between the Shvarim and the Trua besides the length, and potentially you get into a problem of making, if you make a Shever too long, it can become a Tkia. So then you should make the Tkia going up tonally and make the Shever going down like a groan. So the Shever, if you listen to a good Baal Tokea, then they will say, then they'll make the Shever like this. And the tkiah like this, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So wait a second. So in other words, the shvarim should always have sort of essentially continuous, tone or something continuous. Like it shouldn't be tongue. Shall we say?
Shouldn't
stop. Actually, stop the
No. So that's one thing. And another thing is a more fundamental disagreement regarding the sound of the trua. That the trua, half of Klal Yisrael, in Sephardim and in most places in Eastern Europe, they used to say do the trua as like a staccato. But in other places, in Germany and in Yemen, so you see there, totally widespread. So like it's not. It's not a Yekesh thing. It's not a Yemeni thing. It's obviously a Remen. It's harkening back to a very very ancient tradition. Yes. There they do the trua as a continuous warbling sound. They go. That's the trua in the Yekesh and the Temani tradition. So I thought it was a better idea. Since you have already all these extra blasts at the end of davening, in order to get the 100 blasts, you might as well get in an extra. It's a sort of a waste if you just do the same thing over again that you did before. So why not get the extra shita about what the trua is? So then in the blast after davening, so we do the trua. We do the trua in the Yekesh Teimani way, in order to get that as well. There's also, but you should also be aware that this, although this it's a presentation, the Sefer Chinuch accords with the opinion of probably most Rishonim, going back all the way to Rav Haigon, the way the Shulchan Aruch presents it is not like this at all. The way the Shulchan Aruch presents it, following the Rambam, is not that they were just different customs in different places and Reb Avohu wanted to make sure that nobody felt excluded, so he said that every place has to do all the different types of shofar blasts. But rather, he said, we really are not sure which is the correct trua. The Torah didn't just have in mind, any broken blast is a good trua. but rather only one of these is correct. So therefore, you have to blow all of them in order to make sure that you got the correct Chirua, and then that's even another reason to do all the different permutations, because we're really not sure. Although again, the simple understanding is that most Rishonim, even though Shulchan Aruch doesn't say like that, most Rishonim say that really you're Yotze with any different type of Chirua. You also have a problem, different Shitas, regarding whether the Shvarim Chirua is done in one breath or two breaths. And what that means, again, if you're getting to all the different permutations, so some people after davening, they spend a while getting through all the different tashitas of how to blow the shofar. And again, normally you'd say that's nuts, crazy chumras. Nobody says you have to be yotze every single shita. But you see already, back to Reb Avo, there is a tradition in regarding to the mitzvah, tkiya shofar specifically, to try to do it in accordance with all the different types. Again, you're not going to, unless you really spend forever, you're not going to get every single permutation. But the more important basic permutations, there is somewhat of a trend nowadays that we try to do it. One of them being this idea of whether you blow the Shvarim Chirua in one breath or two breaths. So the simple understanding is that if you blow them in one breath, it's for sure good. Even if really lechatchila you're supposed to blow it in two breaths, maybe you should, because the Rishalmi says, actually, that even if you do the Tkia and the Trua, which are two totally different sounds in one breath, then you're Yotze. But, so it should be, certainly, that if you do the Shvarim Trua, which is really one sound altogether in one breath, it should certainly be good. But nevertheless, Rabbeinu Tam says that it's not normal to groan and cry in one breath. You take a little breath between the two, so therefore you should do it in two breaths. It's a Shaila. Maybe Rabbeinu Tam means that if you don't do it in two breaths, you're not Yotze, which does seem difficult. But anyway, that's why the tradition nowadays, the old Ashkenazi minhag recorded by the Ramaz, do everything in two breaths, which seemingly gets you nowhere, or not been the best situation. But the minhag nowadays is recorded by the Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch, and the Achronim say as well, that the minhag is that during the Tkiyos before Musaf, you do it in one breath, and then the tekiyos during Musaf, you do it in two breaths. And then there's a shaila as to what one breath versus two breaths means. That the Chazon Ish says, the Mishnah Berurah says, which is normally accepted opinion, that one breath means that you don't pause in between the amount of time that it takes to take a breath. So, for example, according to the Mishnah Berurah, one breath would be like, you took a very slight pause in between, but not enough time to take a breath. And two breaths would be that either you actually took a breath in between, or you paused in between the amount of time that it takes to take a breath. The Chazon Ish says no, Mishnah Berurah, well, that's two breaths. Any pause in between means two breaths. When it says one breath, it means that you literally go straight from the Svarim into the Trua with no pause whatsoever. So it'd be like, so it's like that's also another permutation that some people try to accommodate. Yeah.
Is there any minimum number of seconds that you see sometimes that, you know, somebody will be standing over the watch and, you know, counting
out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, not number of seconds per se, but the Mishnah says that the Terua and the Tkia are supposed to be the same length. So the Gemara discusses what exactly that means. Some say it means that all the Shvarim, that all the Truas together should be the same length as all the Tkiyas, which means that the Tkiyah only has to be a half a length of the Trua, because there are twice as many Tkiyos as Truas. But the simple understanding, according to most poskim, is that the Tkiyah and the Trua literally have to be the same length. So when you're doing a Shvarim Trua, again, it's a little bit more complicated. I'm simplifying a little bit, but that when you do a long Shvarim Trua together, so the Tkiya that surround the Tkiyos that surround them should be the same length, or at least with enough time in order that in theory you could do a Shvarim Trua. So that's why one of the things that as one of that the Makri, which maybe we're running out of time, so maybe we'll discuss more about that next time. We have nowadays the minhag of a makri, that you have somebody calling out the blast of the shofar. So one of his jobs is to make sure that all of the blasts are the proper length, because when you have the long shvarim trua, So then it's sometimes difficult for the Baal Tekiah to make the Tekiah sufficiently long. So you have to time it. Okay, so next time maybe we'll get into some more of the details about the shofar blowing.